Welcome to Beat Infertility, a podcast where we get real about infertility, empower you to take back control, and provide you with hope for the future. Ready? Here's your host, fellow infertility warrior, Heather Hooman.
Welcome to bonus episode 304. Today's guests are infertility warriors Carolyn Dubay and Kaylee McDonald of Fertility Matters Canada. We will be discussing access to fertility coverage and support across Canada. You can find Carolyn and Kaylee at fertilitymatters.ca. And as always, don't forget to visit our website for more information about this episode at beatinfertility.co/bonus304. Take a listen. Carolyn and Kaylee, welcome to the show.
Hi,
thanks for having us.
Carolyn, I'm going to start with you. You are the executive director of Fertility Matters Canada, which is Canada's premier voice for fertility issues, similar to Resolve here in the U.S. Why don't you take us through your career and what made you want to work in this space?
Sure. Fertility Matters Canada is a Canadian charity, and we provide support, information, education, and we advocate for equal access to fertility care for all those who may need it. I walked the fertility path, my own fertility journey, several years ago, and have come out on the other side. I've got three little boys, all born as a result of IVF ICSI. And when I started advocating, because I didn't have access to some supports while I was going through my own journey, about 7 or 8 years ago, I found Fertility Matters. My husband and I, we started out, you know, as sort of society tells us to, I went to university, I got a master's degree, I met a guy, we dated, we got married, we bought a house. We got jobs, and then we started to try to have a family in that order, as we sort of are told by society to do. And luckily for me, I had a previous job, and a manager of mine was very vocal over the years we worked together about your fertility health. And she said, if you ever encounter an issue and you're trying to get pregnant and it's not happening, you need to advocate for yourself. Don't wait. Don't wait a year like they tell you. Just advocate and figure out if something is going on. And so for us, we were going through the process of trying to have a baby, and we weren't getting pregnant. And we only waited about 3 or 4 months before I actually said to my husband, I think that something's wrong and let's get tested. Luckily for us, he was at that time a member of the Canadian Armed Forces and had quicker access to an initial appointment with a physician, and he was referred immediately to a urologist. So he got tested, and then even while I was waiting for my own testing, his testing came back, and it turns out that we did have male factor fertility issues. We were quickly referred to a fertility clinic, but all of that sort of from the time we started to try to have a baby until getting into a fertility clinic took a good year, 14 months maybe. Before we could have that initial appointment. And it was a really long, challenging year, full of frustration and emotion and sadness. So
I presume you kept trying on your own during those 14 months?
We did. Yep, we did. However, my husband had a very low sperm count. And the reference the urologist gave us is you need an army and you have a soldier. And so we knew that the likelihood of this actually happening on our own was quite low. And what was interesting for us, looking back, not while we were in the trenches, was how we both were grieving, and at very different times. He was sad or upset. I was so entrenched in it that I actually didn't recognize it. And so I would be angry and frustrated with him, and vice versa. And so we learned quickly that we really needed to seek support outside of our partnership. We had to find other people who kind of had been through this, who kind of could understand. I didn't talk about it with my friends. I didn't know anybody that really was struggling or that was openly talking about their struggles. And so I felt very alone. And for someone who's quite extroverted and close to their family, and I have a super amazing group of friends, I was embarrassed and I didn't actually know how to talk about it. And so that was something that we really struggled with as a couple. And at one point, my husband actually said to me, in fact, we probably had the conversation more than once, he sat me down and said, if you want to get a divorce, I will understand because this is not what we signed up for. I am the reason you are unable to have a family. And maybe it is best if we get a divorce so that you can move on and find someone that you can have a family with. That was a really eye-opening one, especially now on this side, looking back, how impactful that was on his mental health. And I didn't really see it like that when we were going through it.
I did the same thing with my husband. I told him that, look, the problem is on my side. We're young. You can go and have a family with somebody else. And of course, we ended up staying together and are a perfectly great couple. We've been together for 19 years. So it's been a wild ride for sure. But I think a lot of people have this conversation with their partner at one point or another.
Absolutely. Sometimes we forget that it's not just a women's issue. It is a couple's issue, whether that is a heteronormative couple or a same-sex couple. This is an issue that you go through together. And it's really important that we continue to have open conversations and dialogue and recognize that these are normal conversations and how to get support in order to help you navigate those conversations and those times.
Once you got into the clinic, where did your journey go from there?
Well, once we had that initial appointment, things moved quite quickly. All of my testing had come back. There was, you know, no reason on paper I shouldn't get pregnant. So we quickly moved because of my husband's low sperm count. We knew that ICSI, so where they take a single sperm and inject that into an egg to fertilize it, was the best option for us. So we went and we did a round of IVF. And I opted for a fresh transfer at that time. We did the transfer and I felt pregnant and I waited for the 2 weeks and I knew I was getting that initial beta blood test. I didn't even test before. I did no home pregnancy test. I waited for that phone call and I'll never forget. It was December 18th and they called and said, "You're not pregnant." It was like the floor fell out from underneath me. I remember my husband, he was upstairs. I was home waiting for the call and had planned like sort of a mini celebration. In my head, after those words came out of the nurse's mouth, I didn't hear anything else. I just hung up. And then my husband came down and I told him, and he had all these questions and I couldn't answer any of them because I actually I wasn't speaking to the nurse after she told me. I had no words to say. So he ended up calling back and getting the information about when you could try again and all those things. So that was a really challenging Christmas season. It was like one more Christmas that we didn't have a family and we were almost felt like impossible because we'd spent all of this money and I didn't ever think that it wasn't going to work. It always was going to work in my head. And so for me, I thought like, I didn't know how to move forward. And then of course, a couple of weeks go by, you get back in for a follow-up appointment. We make plans for a frozen embryo transfer, which we did in March. Year after, or, you know, 3 or 4 months later in the new year. And I did get pregnant with my son, my firstborn. So he was born December 16th. So almost a year to the day of me getting that first negative beta test. So it's kind of interesting. I think back of that fondly on how much can actually change in your year. You know, I had what I would consider one of the worst days of my life. And then almost a year to the day my son was born. And it's pretty special.
Kaylee, you've been on the show before a couple of times, but could you remind listeners about your journey, where you are now, and about your work with Fertility Matters?
So I was just like Carolyn and like most of the world. My husband and I set out to have babies. We had done all the things that you're supposed to do. And I remember we waited until we were a little settled and we were on this beautiful trip to Scotland and Ireland. I think we were in Scotland when we had our conversation. And we were like, you know, was thinking about it on the plane ride over and maybe it's time, like we should start a family. And he was like, you know, it's so funny you say that. I was having the same thing. And I was like, okay. I think I was halfway through like my birth control pack and I threw it in the garbage. And I remember like we had one wild night where we're like, this is it. I mean, obviously not, because I'm like still coming off of the pill at this point, but like not really knowing anything about fertility and stuff. I was like, okay, well, who knows? Maybe I'm not far enough into the pill pack that it could still happen. or maybe I'll get my period and then we'll get pregnant like right after. And there was just this like bubbling of joy, this like amazing, exciting time where now we've decided to start a family. But obviously, as I'm on your show, it didn't work out that way. We tried for a full year. We waited the whole year. I wish that I'd had a manager like yours, Carolyn, who would say, you know, like go and get looked at. Because by the time a year hits, you're generally pretty concerned and, you know, thinking there must be something wrong. And I went to my GP and I had said, you know, we've been trying for a year. I've been tracking my ovulation. Something is wrong. Like nothing is working. And she said, you know, I think I was 26 at the time. She said, you're so young. Just keep trying. Like, there's no reason for you to be worried. Just keep trying. And I said, you know, it's been a year. I'm going to insist that you send me for fertility testing. We will keep trying, but I would like to be tested. And thank God that I had that conversation with her because, you know, and then we have to wait for fertility, like to get into a fertility clinic takes longer. And so we just waited and waited and got into a clinic. I think it took, God, another probably 10 months. So at this point, we've been trying almost 2 years. And I was 28 when we got the diagnosis that I had diminished ovarian reserve. And so diminished ovarian reserve means that you have less follicles available every month, like you're running out of eggs. And the ones that you do produce and ovulate are a little bit better at playing hard to get. And so they were harder to fertilize. And so it dropped. I think they said I had like a 5 to 10% chance of falling pregnant naturally, which was really devastating news to get. When I went into that doctor's appointment, I had no idea that it would be my eggs. I wasn't even 30. So like, I thought maybe I had PCOS or something like, but I never thought that it would be that my eggs were dwindling and that I was closer to menopause than I thought I would be. And it just was a really hard thing to kind of wrap my head around. And so we went on trying a bunch of different things. We tried Clomid and timed intercourse. We tried Clomid with IUI. And I am crazy on Clomid. I am not a nice person. I should not be allowed to take Clomid. And so after doing 2 IUIs and 2 timed cycles with Clomid, I decided that I was done with that and that we would move on to IVF. We were pretty concerned about how I would respond to IVF meds because I had never ovulated more than 1 egg on Clomid. Like I think we eventually got me up to 150, the dose, I think, for Clomid. And I never ever had more than 1 egg develop. I never ovulated more than 1 egg. And so we were a little bit worried that I wouldn't respond well to the stimulation drugs for IVF. And so we went into IVF a little bit concerned. I remember I had looked at all of the options for egg donor clinics in the States because we don't have as many donor options in Canada. And I had picked out a few people that like, if this didn't work, maybe we would contact an egg bank and maybe I would choose one of these donors. And it kind of gave me a sense of control in what felt like a really uncontrollable situation. But we were actually very fortunate, even though I didn't respond super well to the stimulating drugs. We only had 7 eggs collected during our IVF cycle. We were lucky and fortunate enough to have 4 make it all the way through to day 5 and be of fairly good quality. And so we went through with our fresh transfer. And I remember being so terrified with that first test because I did test at home before we went for our beta, but I waited until I think it was the day before our beta before I took it because I didn't want to have a negative and then have to wait taking the drugs for a lot longer afterwards. That would have been really hard emotionally. So I waited until the day before. And I remember like having this conversation with myself. I'm pressed up with my back against the wall so I can't see the test on the counter. And I'm like, okay, Kaylee, you're just going to take 1 step forward and it's going to be fine. And if there's only 1 line, then you'll be all right. And like, you already have this idea of what you might have to do moving forward and it'll be awful, but you'll survive it. Just like you've survived looking at all of the other negative pregnancy tests leading up to this moment. And so I took a deep breath and I stepped forward and I saw 2 lines for the first time ever. At this point, we were 3.5 years into our fertility journey and just being shocked and elated. And I remember like crumbling to the floor and just sobbing and being just so relieved and terrified and excited. And all of those things that I had been feeling all those years before in Scotland, where you're like, this is it, I'm sure of it. and finally getting to a point where you're like able to finally be pregnant. It was really exciting.
Okay. So we were talking off air about this. I think that there's a lot of misconceptions here in the United States about what the healthcare system is like in Canada. So, as an American, I definitely don't know as much about the fertility support system and clinics in Canada as I should, which is why we are here today. Carolyn, how do you feel the atmosphere differs in Canada from the US?
Well, in Canada, we have free healthcare. You have a disease or an issue, you can have your surgery for free, you can see your doctor for free, you walk in, and it might take you several weeks or months to get an actual appointment. So that's part of our challenge. But even though that is true, fertility care and fertility treatment coverage in Canada is not free. We do not have a national fertility strategy, and our healthcare is delivered by province. And there are only 5 provinces in Canada that provide some sort of fertility support, so public funding of fertility treatment. And all of those programs in each of the provinces vary. They're not the same. So unlike someone who has had a heart attack or someone who has diabetes, they can go to their physician for free. They likely need some healthcare, like a benefit plan for their drugs. Those, for the most part, that is covered, that disease is covered. But the disease of infertility, you know, you have to go to a clinic, you have to pay a fee to see a doctor, you have to pay a fee to have your ultrasound, you have to pay a fee to have an IVF treatment. And so as much as we would love for this treatment to be covered under a universal healthcare plan, it is not. So that's probably something that Americans might not consider, knowing that we do have free healthcare here. So one thing that, you know, access to fertility care in Canada is not easy. We are a huge country, and although our population is not nearly as high as the United States, for the population of about 38 million Canadians, we have about 5.5 to 6 million who would be affected here by infertility or fertility struggles. And we only have about 35 clinics in the country total for patients to access. And there are provinces in this country that don't actually even have a fertility clinic. So if you live in a province like Newfoundland or Prince Edward Island, you actually have to leave your province, go to another province to get access to a fertility specialist. When we look at public funding, so of the 5 provinces that do provide some sort of funding, if you're in Ontario, that province actually covers a round of IVF. So on average, a round of IVF in Canada is about $20,000. That's the medical side plus your drugs. And of course, we know that there's no guarantee of a take-home baby at the end of that treatment. So as a young couple, a young individual, you're starting out in life, in your career, lots of people don't have that money sitting around in a bank account to just pay a clinic in the hopes of coming home with a baby. And so, of course, the financial barrier is huge. So if you live in Ontario, for example, you can get a free round of IVF that does not cover your medication. So if you don't have drug coverage, or if you do have drug coverage, but fertility medication is not covered in your drug plan, that's still an out-of-pocket cost for a patient. And so that access to care because of the financial piece is probably our biggest challenge as a country and as patients that live here. There are other provinces, for example, New Brunswick has a one-time grant. So you would pay up front for all of your treatment, and you can apply for a one-time refund from the province of 50% of your cost up to $5,000. So if you're paying $20,000 for a cycle, that $5,000 is certainly helpful, but it definitely does not increase access to care, because if you don't have the money up front to start with, or unable to remortgage a home or take out a line of credit or borrow from family and friends, you're never able to actually put your foot through the door. So as an organization, we believe that we do need a national fertility strategy, a federal statement and policy that says we are prioritizing fertility care, and the provinces should put into place supports, financial supports to help patients get their treatment. But until such a time, and that's probably several years down the road. We're calling on all stakeholders to play a part. So we are advocating at the provincial level with provincial governments to have a look if they're currently giving benefits or providing some public funding, to look at that and make sure that they have, that they're adequate and that maybe they can be improved. We're also, we've got a new project that we've launched with a patient advocacy group in Ontario called Conceivable Dreams. And the campaign is called Fertility Benefits Matter. We are speaking with insurance providers and employers in the country to talk to them about the business case and the importance of considering having reproductive health care covered as a benefit for their employees. The research shows us that women specifically who are diagnosed with a fertility struggle, whether it's with them or with their partner, their productivity at work, their ability to do day-to-day activities is significantly impacted. And as a result, it can impact productivity at work, then it's impacting the organization as a whole. And so we're having these conversations with employers to say, you know, supporting the mental health of your employees and supporting a more diverse and inclusive workplace by providing benefits that consider surrogacy or egg donation or adoption as options for not only heteronormative couples, but also members of the LGBTQ community who, if they want to go on to have a family, really do need to have access to fertility care in order to help them achieve that.
So it seems like the romantic notion that we have down here in the States of you guys just strolling into clinics and paying nothing and walking out very quickly having done IVF is absolutely incorrect.
Absolutely incorrect. It couldn't be farther from the truth. The global need for IVF treatment is 1,500 cycles per 1 million population. So that's the global standard in terms of need for fertility care. And in Canada, we're in and around 350 cycles per million. We're only doing a fifth of what we need to be doing. And that's likely because of a patient's inability to access a clinic. They don't actually know that they have that option. And an even bigger portion is they don't have the funding to even attempt to have this option to build their family.
Kaylee, as a patient yourself, how did you find navigating these challenges?
Well, it was really incredibly difficult. I'm very fortunate that I live in Alberta, which means that I have two clinics in our entire province. I'm lucky that I live in a major center, and so I didn't have to travel very far to get to my clinic. But Alberta as a whole does not offer reimbursement for and no payment upfront for fertility treatments and cycles. When I was cycling, I was actually self-employed. And so I had no drug coverage. I had no benefits to access through my employer. My husband did have drug coverage, but I think it was capped at $3,000 for fertility drugs. Anybody who's taken a fertility drug can tell you that that's not going to go very far. And so by the time we got to our IVF cycle, I think we had half of our allotted drug coverage left. My drugs cost $7,000, and I think like maybe 2,000 of them were covered. So that's still around, you know, 3,000 out of pocket. And then on top of that is the actual IVF procedure itself, which is not covered at all. And there's no reimbursement program for it in the province of Alberta. And so like, I think we make a joke that our son is the $10,000 man, because that's about how much we paid in order to do that IVF round. And we were lucky that it was successful. If it wasn't successful, like many first attempts at IVF aren't, then you're looking at another $10,000 or more. I guess it would have been even more, because then you don't have drug coverage left. And it just becomes an unreachable goal for so many people. Like, I don't know a lot of people that are in their, you know, late 20s, maybe early 30s, who have multiple 10,000s just kicking around in case they needed it to try and have a child, right? And then you're also supposed to raise your child, which is not inexpensive either. But I consider myself pretty lucky because at least I had access to care. So some of the provinces, like Carolyn was saying, that don't have even one clinic in the whole province. So in Newfoundland, you have to travel out of province. So how long are you taking then? Like, I think usually people take 2 weeks to be able to come to another province. You have to take time off work. You have to put yourself up in a hotel. You have to cover all of that out-of-pocket travel expense as well. And then you still have to pay the fertility treatment costs on top of it. And it's just so suffocating. Even later, so we went on to have another child. I have a daughter as well. And we got pregnant with her in the run-up to an FET. So she wasn't the result of a frozen transfer, but she was conceived in that cycle. I know it's kind of confusing. I'm not going to go into it. But we had already paid $2,000 in order to have the FET cycle. And then I got pregnant without having to transfer the embryo. And I was only able to be reimbursed a little over half of that, even though I didn't use it. So like, there are so many gaps and ways that you as a patient might kind of have to allocate a lot of funds and a lot of time in order to do this. And it's really distressing financially, but also emotionally. Without even having to talk about the financial cost, if you have to travel for treatment, what are you telling your employer? What if you're not ready to disclose that you have fertility struggles? Like, I can't, it's really not a very fair system up in Canada. There's not a lot of equity between the provinces as to what it looks like to access fertility care. But definitely across the board, we can say the one thing that's consistent is that it's hard.
Hey, Infertility Warrior, it's Heather. This episode of Beat Infertility is brought to you by me. In addition to hosting this podcast, I'm an infertility coach who supports warriors just like you. Regular listeners know that I struggled during my journey to make good decisions and advocate for myself. As a result, it took 5 years, $75,000, 3 egg retrievals, 7 embryo transfers, 4 miscarriages, and 2 stillbirths before I finally had my daughter. In other words, I've been where you are. Now that I'm on the other side, I help people like you navigate the complicated world of fertility treatments and other paths to parenthood. I help people like you make scientifically based, well-informed decisions about your next steps rather than relying on Dr. Google and Facebook groups. I help people like you prepare for appointments, identify opportunities to ask questions, and advocate for yourself. I help people like you become an active member of your fertility treatment team rather than blindly trusting the decisions that are made for you. I help people like you become a parent faster. I only have a couple of slots open and they generally fill up fast. So if this is the help you need, reach out today. Tell me your story and learn more about how I can support you during your infertility journey at beatinfertility.co/hope. Now, back to the show. We, of course, have states where there are very few clinics. I am lucky. I live in what we call the DMV, the DC, Maryland, Virginia area. They are like Starbucks here. There are so many locations that you can pick from. How many clinics are in Canada altogether?
Yeah, there's about 35 clinics in Canada, and not every province actually has one. So that's something. And the majority of those clinics are in the Greater Toronto Area,
which is one city, for those of you who don't know Toronto.
Yeah. So it's, you know, I think there's about, I don't know, 15 clinics in Toronto. There's about 4 or 5 in Vancouver, probably another 5 or 6 in the Montreal area. So if you think about those three cities taking up approximately 22, 23 of the 35, that leaves not very many other clinics for the seven other provinces and all of our territories, which are up in the north. So it's incredibly inaccessible for lots of patients who live outside big urban centers. Something that's also interesting to think about now that we're in this pandemic, Canada has much stricter COVID rules, it seems, than the U.S. If you are traveling to a clinic, for example, from one province and sometimes from one city to another, you actually have to quarantine for 2 weeks when you arrive, because those are our COVID restrictions right now. So If you are living in New Brunswick and you need to get access and your clinic is in Nova Scotia, you need to go to Nova Scotia and quarantine for 2 weeks, then do your treatment. And then when you come home, there is also a quarantine restriction. So what's happening is some clinics are just not even accepting patients from outside of their jurisdictions. And so that's decreased access for some patients, depending on where they live.
Please correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe the US-Canada border is closed right now. And so you guys can't even come down here.
Exactly. So the border is closed. It makes it incredibly challenging, especially when the borders initially closed a year ago. It was causing huge issues for international surrogacy. So sometimes a surrogate would be in one country and the intended parents would be in the other country, and they weren't able to access each other until we sort of figured out how to do this. Because of the restrictions in the hospitals, lots of times patients are now going into egg retrievals, initial appointments, all of those things alone, without a partner, because they've limited the number of people that are allowed into a lot of these appointments. So it's taken away a huge personal aspect of the treatment cycle. And I know our physicians and our fertility experts here, I mean, they're amazing, and they're feeling it. And when I'm speaking with them, it's sad, because they say, you know, we're helping this couple or these individuals build their families. And quite often it's a husband on FaceTime or a partner on FaceTime at home, or sitting in the car in the parking lot while their partner's having an egg retrieval or even a transfer. It's taken a piece of it away. And I know that the medical teams are working really hard to, they can't even touch patients anymore. You know, they have to stay so far away. Before, a nurse would hold your hand during your embryo transfer, or those intimate moments when you have with your nurse calming you down if you're afraid of needles and they're taking your blood every morning. It's really put some space there. And eventually we will get back to a place where we can be closer. But for now, it's really taken away another level of more intimate care that we have been used to.
Okay. I also wanted to say, we lived in Houston for 5 years. So I have a lot of friends who are in Houston. And I think there's a medical center. The Houston Medical Center is like a thing. It's really big and really impressive. And so there are a lot of clinics right in the Houston area. And so I have a few friends who are going through infertility in Houston. And like, our interaction with the medical system was so markedly different. Like I said, I'm lucky to have a clinic right where I live. And so I travel 20 minutes to get to my clinic, and I'm in the same city and I can be at home at night. But my friends were like shopping clinics where they would go to, you know, three or four to see where can they get the best package, who has the nicest like waiting rooms and different perks that you can have. Like, it was just a completely different experience. I was like, okay, cool, I have a clinic, thank God. Okay, I can go there, and I hope that I like my doctor, because there are no choices if I don't like my doctor. And side note, my first doctor, I did not like. She didn't have great bedside manner, and I was still very raw and feeling awful about the fact that my eggs were the issue. And she was just like really blunt. And I told us at one point that we should just skip everything else, because I probably wouldn't have success unless we went straight to IVF. But this was so early in my journey that I wasn't ready to hear that yet. She was probably right, but her delivery was off. And so I did end up asking to switch doctors at the clinic, which is something that they only allow you to do one time before you would have to then leave the clinic to get different help. And so I remember being so concerned, because they wouldn't let you pick your next doctor. They just switch you to whoever has an opening. And I think there are only 5 doctors at my clinic. So it was like, spin the roulette wheel. Who do I get next? And am I going to like them any better? Meanwhile, my friend in Houston had a bad experience at a clinic, and like was able to leave that clinic, go across the road to another clinic and have a completely different experience. And if she had not liked that clinic, she could have done the same thing, I think like 3 or 4 more times before she would have run out of options. Whereas I had to stay in the same clinic where I could still see and run into the doctor that I didn't like, that I had basically fired. But I had to do that because the next closest clinic is 5 hours away. And so it was just like such a crazy differential between how I felt like my friends in the States had all of this access to care and all of these options. And like clinics compete against each other where they try to like give you a package deal. So if it doesn't work out, you get like so many rounds included, which is not a thing here because there's no competition. You pay what you pay, you get who you get as a physician, and that's it.
I was on the Fertility Matters website earlier this morning, and I found a page about alternative funding. Can you tell us a little bit about that, Carolyn?
So I think the alternative funding, there's very little alternative funding in Canada. There are no sort of fertility funds to access. As an organization, we are not giving funds to patients to help them access care. There are a couple of organizations, for example, Fertile Future, and they work with young cancer patients. So they provide, they're a nonprofit and provide funding to young cancer patients to either have, for example, if it's a young female and she needs to undergo care, prior to cancer treatment, they can provide funding that will help support the treatment process. And quite often in those situations, the pharmaceutical companies will provide medication under a compassionate care so that access, because quite often in those situations, the care needs to happen quickly. They also provide funding for a couple who is a cancer survivor and needs to go on to IVF. You know, they've completed care and can now try to start to have a family, but need to have IVF as an example in order to complete their, to build or complete their family. And so they provide some care that way. But other than that, there's very, very little other than a few provinces who do provide some funding.
There are also a few one-off charities. There's one in Saskatchewan, there's one in Alberta, where you can kind of apply to like be entered into a lottery and they will award what usually amounts to coverage for one treatment cycle, but you only can do it once. So you can apply to these charities who do fundraising efforts and they then basically draw a name out of the hat. And if you're lucky, they pick your name and they will cover a cycle for you. But it shouldn't be a lottery system. There shouldn't have to be charities in each province that specifically do this to help one couple access care that they should need. So like there are a few groups that can also give you like what you would consider alternative funding, but they're few and far between and not every province and territory offers them.
Yeah. And it may help access to a handful of people any given year. It's not something that's widespread.
When this airs, it will be Canadian Infertility Awareness Week and National Infertility Awareness Week here in the U.S. What does this mean to you, Carolyn? And what do you guys have in the works? And what is your focus going to be for this year?
So Canadian Infertility Awareness Week is a week for us to celebrate everybody who is walking this journey. We want to raise awareness, we want to educate patients, and we really want to educate the public, not only on how prevalent this disease is in Canada and how many people actually need to access care or utilize fertility care in order to build their families, but we also want to celebrate all the different ways we build families in 2021. So not only because you are medically infertile as a heterosexual couple, but you are a single person who hasn't found a partner but wants to start a family and needs to access care, or you're a member of the LGBTQ community and want to have a baby and you need a surrogate and an egg donor. These are all ways that we are building modern families in Canada and across the globe. And so we want to celebrate that and educate on that and help drive the conversation so that people who are walking this path feel comfortable talking about it, feel comfortable sharing their story. And if they aren't comfortable doing those things, that they're seeing other people around them sharing so they feel less alone. Our theme for CIAW 2021 is Hear Us. And it's a real grassroots movement of patients and those who support patients, those who work in the fertility industry, to say, hear us, hear our story. It is important, and it is something that we need to normalize talking about, whether that's with our group of girlfriends or in the workplace. And so we're encouraging everybody who can participate to share. And if you don't have a personal connection, or if you think you don't have a personal connection to fertility, learn and educate yourself so that you can support other people in your network who may be struggling in silence.
I wanted to say that this year for CAIW, Fertility Matters is doing like a hashtag challenge. And so I wanted to kind of just touch on one because of something that Carolyn said. On Monday, our hashtag is 6 degrees of separation, because we're encouraging people to kind of broaden the conversation this year. We always want to see people who are dealing with fertility challenges speak up and use their voice to give kind of a face to this community during CAIW. But also, it's interesting that even if you don't think you have a connection or you don't identify as somebody who has had fertility challenges, and there are lots of people that don't, that we would challenge you to kind of think outside the box, because we've been finding that it's like that 6 degree of separation thing where you really do. So maybe it's your cousin who is infertile and you've had to support them, or maybe you're a grandparent who doesn't have grandchildren and that's impacting your life, even though you're not the one dealing with fertility challenges. Or maybe you're an IVF nurse and you deal all day long with helping people cope with this diagnosis and treatment plan that they didn't really want. And that wasn't part of their original dream for their lives. And so I think that it's really important during CAIW, but all through the year, to really think about how wide-reaching fertility struggles can actually be. I would say that they impact like the broader community and not just the couple. Of course, the couple is who feels, or the person who's struggling to conceive on their own, the person dealing with challenges bears the brunt of it emotionally and financially, but it doesn't stop there. And that fertility challenges do really extend into the whole community. And there are ripple effects. Maybe your friend just lost a baby and you want to support them through a miscarriage. Maybe you are an employer and it had never occurred to you that you would like to support some of your employees who are dealing with fertility challenges, and that there are probably multiples in your current working scenario that would benefit from that kind of a program. And it's just important to kind of think about all of the different ways that people are touched by, you know, diagnosis of infertility or challenges with growing their family, if they are part of the LGBTQ community or if they are a single parent by choice. There are a lot of people that are kind of affected in the broad swath of our community, not just those that are directly dealing with it.
Is there anything we in the U.S. can be doing to help our fellow Canadian warriors and maybe vice versa to access care?
Well, we've got a really strong relationship with Resolve. So they are, of course, the organization in the U.S. that does very similar advocacy and education that Fertility Matters does. And so I truly believe that fertility is a global conversation. There is no country, no corner of this earth that is not affected. And so for our friends in the U.S. to continue the conversation, to continue sort of that cross-border connection and education and sharing your stories in the U.S. helps people not only in Canada, but across the globe. I think part of a silver lining of the COVID pandemic has been more people connecting, and conversations are happening more globally as people have all moved online to collect information, to meet. People are now working remotely, which means they don't necessarily need to live in a specific city where their organization is. And as a result, we're seeing an increase in sort of our international traffic to our Facebook pages. I even find myself going to other international organizations and spaces to collect information and to connect. So continuing the conversation and by supporting, you know, Resolve in the work that they do is incredibly important. And we will continue to link arms with them and sort of have this North American movement of advocacy and education so that we can help change the conversation together.
I think it's so important to say that, like, okay, so I used to have a blog and I know that I have people that have reached out to me from the US, and my journey being online has so helped them on their journey because they had similar circumstances or they felt the same feelings that I was experiencing. And so I think that it goes both ways. If I can impact somebody in Virginia, then for sure somebody from Virginia can impact a patient up in Canada. And so like that broad dialogue of fertility struggles can be so powerful to helping people that are navigating that feel less alone. And we all know that on the infertility journey, feeling alone is incredibly common, even though you're actually sitting in a room with so many other people. I think that it's so important for people to be able to gain access to people from all over in making this a less taboo subject.
What do you think is reasonable for your organization to accomplish over the next year? What do you see changing?
If we can continue to have conversations with employers, one of our big pushes this year is to meet with some of Canada's biggest employers to start the conversations about inclusive fertility benefits as options for their employees. We also have quite a few advocacy groups on the ground doing work, advocating for better provincial coverage and consideration for coverage in their jurisdictions. So if we can meet with different government groups and different employers and insurance providers to make changes and have them come back to us and say, yes, we're going to consider. And the reality is these things don't happen overnight. They don't happen in a month. It takes months, sometimes years to make changes. But if everybody's starting to take steps to be more diverse and inclusive and supporting the mental health of patients who are struggling with fertility, it will be a huge win for our organization. We are a charity. We're not a profit, for-profit organization. If we can have more corporations partnering with us so that we can pour more money back into programming and education and advocacy work on behalf of Canadian patients, that will be a huge win for everybody that we support.
Kaylee, is there anything else you'd like to share?
I wanted to go back for a minute to talk about how cross-border stuff is important between Canada and Fertility Matters to the U.S. with Resolve. I wanted to say that worldwide even, but especially in the States, when Resolve has like an advocacy day or another state adds better coverage or fertility benefits become mandated, those things do trickle across the border. And even though we're not in the same country, they do influence the conversations that are being had. So like New Zealand just added the bereavement leave after a stillbirth or a miscarriage. And that sparks conversations here in Canada as well as in the States for better coverage around loss. And so I feel like all of the advocacy work that's happening all around the world isn't really bound by its own borders. And it really does help other advocacy groups here in Canada to be able to start having other conversations. And instead of it just being like screaming into the void and people being like, well, like nobody is doing that, you can say, well, yeah, they are. Like in this state, they've just awarded fertility coverage. In New Zealand, they just awarded, you know, miscarriage benefits. There are people doing this already. And it does help to kind of get the conversation going here on this side of the border. And so when you look at how discussing things with like an American company or like with you, with an American podcast, why is this important? It's because the borders aren't as hard and fast for things like support and things like ideas as they are for maybe other things like shipments. It's much more free flowing, especially because of the internet and how online we are. And just to asking people to keep going on, keep advocating and keep fighting for coverage right where you are. And you never know the ripple that you're going to have in other states, but also in other countries.
I have one final question for the both of you. What words of hope would you offer to Canadian infertility warriors who are still on this journey? Carolyn, I'll throw it to you first.
My words of hope are that there is an entire community of people, not only in this country, but on a global scale, who are walking and who will potentially walk or find themselves in similar situations that you find yourself in. And if you're struggling and you're feeling like you're so alone and this is isolating and no one understands, please know that you can reach out. You can do a Google search and find support groups of like-minded peers who can really empathize with what you're going through. You do not have to do this alone. And in fact, it's really important to know that if you're feeling that this is really impacting your mental health, we know that the research shows that an infertility diagnosis has the same impact on someone's mental health as a cancer diagnosis. And we don't treat it the same. So I want to validate how you're feeling and know that there are supports and resources out there that you can access a lot of times for free to help you move through some of those things. So reach out to Fertility Matters Canada. If you're in the US, reach out to Resolve and we'll help guide you to get the resources that you need to move forward.
Kaylee?
I just want to say that you are stronger than you think you are, and you can do really, really hard things. That doesn't mean that it will be without its challenges. That doesn't mean that it won't hurt and that it won't suck really badly. It probably will. This type of journey towards parenthood is not easy, and it is not for the faint-hearted. But I know that all of my friends and all of the people in the community that I've connected with who have moved through infertility and are now either parents or have decided to be childless, not by choice, or have had to stop their treatments for one reason or the other, and they are not able to continue. All of those outcomes, as varied as they are, all of those people have gotten through something and gained strength that serves them so well in all of the things that they go forward and do with that. Yes, it can be painful. Sometimes, you know, you need therapy to bounce back from it, but it can make you stronger and it can make you a more empathic person. I feel like I have really gained from my journey, like my 7-year fertility journey, that people are going through things that you don't know about, and to just be compassionate and to understand that even if somebody is walking around looking fine, doesn't mean that they're not carrying a burden and a pain inside of them that might be so, so difficult for them to carry right now. And that one of the best ways to get help is just to reach out. Be willing to be vulnerable with where you are at in your struggle, because there are so many people that would love to help you carry that burden and who understand and have been there. There are probably even people in your circle that understand. They may not have spoken out about it yet, but usually when you unburden yourself and say that you're having these struggles, people kind of come out of the woodwork to say, you know, I've had miscarriages. It took me 5 years to have my children. I'm not able to have children, but we've been trying. Like, there are so many people all around you who really understand and want to support you. And even though it's hard, you can keep going and get through it. And there will be so much exciting life on the other side, no matter your outcome.
Carolyn, Kaylee, thank you so much for coming on the show today. I appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having us.
Thanks, Heather. It was great talking to you.
Thank you for listening to Beat Infertility. Join our free private support community at beatinfertility.co/app. If you find yourself needing additional support, visit our paid programs at beatinfertility.co/hopeyou. If you'd like your story to be considered for a future episode, please fill out the form at beatinfertility.co/contact. Until next time.